God, look at the mob. I'm Jim Pearson. I'm an alcoholic. I was David Randall's sponsor when he first moved to North Carolina. It's a really incestuous fellowship when you think about it. It's good to see all of you. What a wonderful weekend. This has been one of the nicest, if not the nicest. I like Unity. I really do. I'm impressed with what you've done. It's good to see you. I have to be honest with you, though. I'm damn glad you can see me. It's been a great weekend. You know, it's a privilege to be in a meeting for me. I like to use the word privilege. One way to explain to you why privilege is what I use is I'm not here because I have to be here, and I came here for that reason, but I don't come here now for that reason. I'm at least to the point in my sobriety where I come to Alcoholics Anonymous to celebrate what I've been given. But for those of you that are younger, and I wish Jude was here or somebody, I'm sure there's an attorney here from Georgia, it hasn't been that many years ago that this disease, probably 45 or 50 years ago in my home state of North Carolina, that this disease was treated by punishment. If you were convicted of habitual drunkenness, you could be sentenced in the state of North Carolina to 2 years in prison. I could talk about that a lot, but that's why it's a privilege to be here. There was no place for my father to go. I'm the grandson of an alcoholic, the son of an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. I'm the father of an alcoholic. I'm the nephew of an alcoholic. I'm the uncle of an alcoholic. Of course, it's not genetic. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me and Lib. It was just perfect timing. I want to make an announcement. At my house, when Lib or I want to announce something to each other, you have to help me out here. We run into the room and say, "Announcement, announcement." And the other one says, "Announce, announce." So you say, "Announce, announce. Go ahead." I'm not wearing a tie and a jacket tonight because I retired the 1st of January. I made a conscious decision to get rid of all of my ties, and there are those who think that that's not right. I've always worn a jacket at the podium. This is the first time. This is a first for me. This is my first Targ talk. And I like the state of Tardship. I recommend it highly. It's easy. All you got to do is stay employed and don't die. It works like that. For those of you that think I should be wearing a tie and a jacket, just stick a sock in it. I was especially touched with the 8111 crowd here last night when Sue was talking. I want to thank all of you. You did something for me, and without knowing it, as she did, I told her this. I was one of the group that, small group of five or six men, and a woman who started 8111, and it was, I didn't have a year sobriety. And my life is rich with examples of what newcomers mean to this fellowship. And maybe I can tell you about a few tonight. I think I'm one of only two people of that original group still living. I guess the moral of it, I thought about this, the moral of the story is don't start a club, you know. Lib, I'd like for my wife to stand up just a second and everybody say, "Hi, Lib." She, you don't need to ask, she's a black belt Al-Anon. When I had a few years sobriety, she persuaded me to stop telling Al-Anon jokes from the podium, and I have done that. She did want me to tell you, though, that it's been over 15 years since she has had an obsession to kill me. Because of this fellowship and grace. Just that simple. Last New Year's Eve, we celebrated 40 years of marriage. I was thanking the committee because Cliff actually called me, and he told me to say thank the committee instead of him for calling me, so that after I'm through talking, you won't know it's him that called me. He talked about Pity Pot this morning, by the way. It was just a marvelous meeting sometime last year. And a young man came in the meeting, and he wanted to talk about self-pity. And so the chairman of the meeting said, go ahead. And he said, I'll tell you what, if my Pity Pot was a pay toilet, I'd be a damn millionaire. I can relate to that, because when I first got sober, I had experience with self-pity. I love the fellow that wrote in the book Shame. He talks about that we deal with dishonesty and fear and resentment and all the other things, but very seldom in meetings do we talk about shame. And I like the book. I recommend it, even though it's not conference literature. He says there are kind of two types that come in here. One, people, when they first come here, they talk like they think they're very special. And others who think when they get here that they're a lowly worm. But only people like me, when they get here, think they are a very special worm. My sponsor came up with me. Some of you may remember Roland from the NABBA Club. Roland walked up to me after a meeting one evening and said, Jim, why don't you come down off the cross? We need the wood. So much for self-pity. I have been sober 9 months and 29 days and 15 years. My sobriety date is the 24th of April of 1980. I asked Bill Hollingsworth one time, what do you do when you tell your story? And he said, pray for guidance right before the meeting and try to tell the truth. Do the best you can to get sober before the end of your talk. And right before you get up there, be sure you go to the bathroom. I did this time. And as I walked away, he said, oh, hey, by the way, stop with hope. I said, what are you talking about? He said, you know, experience, strength, and hope. You've heard him say this. Experience, strength, and hope. He said, try to steer clear of your infinite wisdom. I usually start, and I like to start my favorite prayer. It tells you a lot about me. God, bend me to your will. Point me in any direction you would have me go. Help me serve my fellow man in any way you see fit. But you and I both know that I could best serve in an executive capacity. I can't wait to hear what I'm going to say tonight. I don't know of anything that gives me a greater spiritual lift than the sound of my own voice, anyway. Somebody suggested that I do this. I usually tell why I don't drink right up front. I don't drink, and I'm serious, I don't drink, number one, because it does not work anymore. It does not do anything for me. It does things to me. If it did things for me, I would drink. It doesn't work. The second reason is, I hear a lot of people talk about, I'm afraid if I drink, I'll die. I have thought a lot about that over the years, and no one wants to die. Everyone's going to. That's not a fear of mine. My single greatest fear is that I'll drink again and not die, based on what happened to me the last time I did it. And the third reason is I'm afraid you'll send Cliff to 12-step me. Can't you see that? Me laying in the floor, puking and sick, and Cliff comes in and says, "Ha ha ha, Jim P. has done took drunk. Bill, come sit on him while I get the van." I hope and pray to God that he never has the chance. My story is real simple. It's in the big book. A man gave me a big book that 12-stepped me, and he said, "You want to look for yourself in that book." I said, "What am I doing here? Where's the good parts?" He said, "Just look for yourself." It's in one sentence. It says, "Alcohol gave me wings to fly, and alcohol took away the sky." That's my story. I can tell you my story in another way. I'm going to do it three ways. This is the second. One of my favorite ways is what happened to my favorite song over the years. When I was young and was going to lick the world, I really liked, probably more than any other song, Frank Sinatra's "I Did It My Way." In the middle years, when I was really into experiencing the things that alcohol did for me, late at night, my favorite song was "Misty." Remember that? And near the end, in the late 70s, it was "Help Me Make It Through the Night." My favorite song now is "Amazing Grace." I can't remember how long ago it was. My wife gave me a little plexiglass enclosed thing of a prayer and prayer of St. Francis, and it has a music box on the back, and it's in my, what I call my pewter room. It's the office where my computer is at the house, and you wind it up and it plays "Amazing Grace." I have never been able to listen to "Amazing Grace" since I've been sober and not cry, because I think that's where it's at. Well, that says it all. Why don't we just say the Our Father and go dance? I mean, that's my story. Well, I got a third way, as you might expect. For those of you that held up your hand less than a year, if there's any doubt in your mind and you start reading the AA literature, some years ago I did that, a good number of years ago, and I picked up the pamphlet. I think this is the original one. And I checked three questions in here. Do you ever try to get extra drinks at a party because you do not get enough? Do you wish people would mind their own business about your drinking and stop telling you what to do? Have you had an eye-opener? That's the word right there that got me. Have you had an eye-opener upon awakening during the past year? Well, I decided I'd develop my own questions. And I did. That doesn't get to the heart of it for me. That's kind of mamby-pamby. I don't mean to criticize the literature of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I have 30 questions in my list, and I do two things. I'll ask you these questions if you're new, and also it's my way of telling you what it was like. This is my story in questions. As far as you know, were you born sober? Now, you may not think that's a very important question, but I have no memory in my childhood, in my case, of not sneaking a few nips of Daddy's wine when he would set the jug down by the chair. If he had a jar, you know, a jar, jars of half gallon of white liquor. He had a jar which was really something, you know. I can't remember ever not sipping it. Long before you ever took the first drink, did you feel different? Did you feel something was missing? Did you spend a lot of time alone, maybe down by the creek or out in the barn or up in the attic like I did? I did. I felt that way more than 10 or 12 years before I ever took a drink. Had you maybe never danced or felt okay in a crowd or been with a girl? Did you ever say, I'll never drink like my father? Did your mama say, if you drink, you'll go to hell? I, of course, thought she meant after I die. But when I was 14, this happened to me. After the first drink, within just a short while, did you feel instantly smarter, stronger, faster, sexier, better looking, a great dancer, and a center of attention in a crowd? I did. I did, and I felt that way for a number of years every time I drank. Did you later that evening think you were bulletproof in a fight? I did. And after a while after that, did you just get downright precious? I mean, you know, I was just precious when I was drinking, huh? But then, did you go home and throw up and take that first ride on the bed, round and round and round? Anybody's going to do that again, and if you do, okay, there's a solution to that. What you do is, when you're in bed, you stick your toe out and touch the floor and open one eye and kind of look at something, and it'll stop that bed. So if you're going to do it, the next morning, did you tell all your friends, boy, I had a good time? After the first drink, do you ever remember just wanting one drink? Now that's true. All that stuff, that's the first 15 years of my life. The last question, by the way, is a clincher question. This is the early symptom part of my story. This counts triple points, this question. Did you grow up in a perfectly normal alcoholic Christian home? I did. I did. The middle stage of my alcoholism was the middle stages were like this. Did you ever wreck your best friend's car and not remember driving? Well, yeah, listen, blackouts, that's a great way to travel. You know, if you're going from Texas to California and you just... Did you ever gag brushing your teeth and blame the toothbrush? Did you ever hit a Cadillac with a Volkswagen on a six-lane highway in California and there weren't any other cars on the road? I nailed him right in the butt about 1 o'clock in the morning. Well, he was parked in the middle lane with the lights off. I mean, he was in the back seat with his girlfriend, and I hit him. It worked out great, by the way. I never got cited for that. Her husband was the county solicitor. Did people say you're such a nice person when you don't drink so much? God. The chronic stages of my alcoholism were like this. Did you ever get in the car and get ready to go to work at your office in Riverside, California, and discover you were in Fort Worth, Texas? I did. Did you ever call in late to work on Monday and find out it's Thursday? I don't care what your denial mechanism is, it's hard to deny what damn day of the week it is. And this is the other question by request I always get. Did you ever take a cab and while you were paying the driver stand there and wet your pants and not even know you were peeing? Now there's a good news and a bad news to this little story. The good news is I was wearing jeans. The bad news is I was wearing boots. I still got them. They about quit stinking. Here's the terminal stage. I have to get a little bit serious here. All these things happen to me that I've said so far. Here's the terminal stage of my alcoholism. Did you ever stagger to the door late at night and drop your 38 on somebody coming trying to get in the door, and just as you pull the hammer back, realize it was your oldest son who has lost his key? Did you ever do that? I fainted. And by the grace of God, the gun didn't go off. Did your wife ever sleep in the other room? Did you think she slept in the other room because she didn't love you, when the fact is that she couldn't stand the way you stink? Did your daughter Sarah write you a letter saying that you were a drunk and that she would not be coming to see you, did not want to be in your presence, did not want to speak to you again for the rest of your life? Have you ever, I got to kind of lighten up a little bit. I'm going to just skip a couple here. You ever had an anxiety attack trying to decide which end to put over the commode first? You can't get people that don't have what we got to laugh at that. You see, all you folks stuck your hand up, you just laughed. It's because you have this experience. Did you ever get to the point where you just took your bottle to the commode? I did this for almost 3 years. So you could take that first drink in the morning and throw up without, you know, messing up everything and having to clean up so much. I did. Did you get to the point that you thought puking was just normal? I did. See, I think this is where we have common ground. I can't say that my puke tastes better than your puke. Puking is puking. Whether it's on a $50 yard carpet or under a bush in a dirty old alley. I think that's our bond. That's my opinion. All right, here's the final clincher question. And I hope you people that knew or knew can relate. Only a real alcoholic has understands this experience. This singly is unique to alcoholics. Did you ever get the toothpaste mixed up with the preparation H? Now, I know what you're thinking, but that ain't it. I'll wait. It'll set you free. All right, so that was what it was like for me. So what happened? I did not listen to anybody. Nothing I tried worked. And I made the classic mistake of the alcoholic, and that is, in the last 4 or 5 years of that story I just told you, I thought I had a drinking problem. Well, obviously, if I had a drinking problem, the way to solve that problem is to don't drink for a little while. And every time I would stop drinking for a while, I got drunk. And finally, what happened to me, this is, you know, what it was like, what happened, what it's like today. What happened is I just kept drinking liquor till the wheels ran off. I don't remember my last drink. A lot of people do. Most people do. I have no conscious decision of taking my last drink. I remember my last first drink. I had not had anything to drink for 30 days. On the 8th of April of 1980, I decided and told Lib, I was living here in Atlanta, I was going to come home, we were going out, and she mentioned I hadn't had anything to drink for a month, and I said, isn't it wonderful? And she said, yes. And I said, why don't we go out and have a couple drinks to celebrate? So I stopped at Green's Liquor Store on Peachtree Industrial Boulevard, right below my office, and I bought 2 half gallons of vodka. Now, I thought about that a lot. Why did I buy 2 half gallons of vodka? I pulled over the side of the road after I left that place on 285. I lived in Sandy Springs. We had a beautiful home over there. And I do not remember getting home that night. That was the 8th of April. What I remember, based on that last first drink, I do remember, is coming to, stuck to the floor in my puke. My tongue and mouth was chewed up so bad from, I knew what that was. I had had convulsions before and chewed my tongue up. My hands and my feet were so swollen I couldn't get my slippers on, or much less, certainly not my boots. I had no idea where I was. I had those tattoos of the drunk. Any of you ever nodded off a lot if you smoke? You know, your cigarette burns you and you have a blister, and so you switch to here, and then you switch to here, and then you switch over here, and sometimes you switch in there. And I still have scars all in my hands from that. I like to look at them. That's where I was, and I thought it was the next morning. And it was not the 9th of April, it was the 24th of April. It was 2.5 weeks later. I thought I was in Atlanta. I was in Wichita Falls, Texas. I thought I was in my bedroom. I was in a rat hole motel. It's a long story I love to tell, but I'm not going to go through it. From there, just getting home. But somewhere between that motel in Wichita Falls, Texas, and that night in my house, I took my last drink. I got home, and Lib met me at the door. That's, by the way, when I paid the cab driver and peed my pants. And Lib met me at the door, and she said, Walter called. And Walter, I'd like to tell this story for new people. When it comes to whether you can or cannot help another drunk. Someone said this morning, and I love it, if you've got one day, you can help somebody that's just got here. Because that was my experience. You hear a lot of things in AA, like you can't carry a message you don't have. And don't ever call on somebody that's in your family. Don't call the people you work with. You know, I've heard all of that. But see, I didn't know all that before I got here. I wasn't suffering with all that information in my head. Walter, she said, was coming over from Louisiana to Atlanta, and I said, what's he coming for? And she said, well, you got to go to the airport at 10 o'clock and get him. I said, at night, and my wife's night blind. And I said, well, what's he coming for? And she said, well, you called him sometime a few days ago and told him that you were an alcoholic and you wanted to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, no, hell no, I didn't. And I said, if you want him, you go get him. And she got in the car and went and got him. Walter had 35 days sobriety. He had been around the program 14 years. He had 7 years one time. He had been a periodic for 7 years. He had been back 35 days after about 4 years. He worked for me. He was one of the best friends I've ever had in my life. And he didn't stay sober. 6 years later, he died. But he would get a few months and weeks here and there. And he got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just wanted to mention that. He came and stayed in our house. Well, the first night, two nights at the house, I couldn't walk. I was in my drunk drawers. I don't know if you men... When I'd get on a bad drunk, I wouldn't change drawers. And Lib used to like to say they had hash marks in the bag. And here I am shaking bad. I got to shaking so bad, I'm barefooted. The only thing I got on is my drawers, my drunk drawers. And he's sitting on the couch. He weighed 385 pounds. He sat in there and broke three springs on my couch. The second thing about this story is he didn't tell me his story. He never answered a question about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd say, what do they do? And he'd say, they'll tell you when you get there. I'd say, well, how do the meetings, because, see, I'd heard, the only thing I'd ever heard, this is the truth, I know it's hard to believe, but it's the truth, about AA was in a bar, and some guy came in and ordered a drink, and he said, God, I'm glad I'm through with that meeting. And some guy said, what kind of meeting? He said, I just came from an AA meeting. And the guy said, what do they do? And he said, they all get in a circle, and they take a bottle and spin it, and whoever it lands on gets to drink it, and the others, pull some, they just have to go all week without a drink. Well, I didn't know better. But he never answered a question. I'll tell you what, 3 days after he came to the house, when we got ready to go, he had to drive. I couldn't wait to get to the meeting. Because he never answered a question. He never mentioned the big book. He never mentioned the steps. The only thing he did was lean down off that couch and put his arms around me and say, Jim, it's going to be okay. That's all he said. And the third miracle of my story is I believed him. I had never believed anybody before, and I believed him. And the next morning, he took me to a meeting. We sat in the parking lot, and I know you've heard these kind of things, but he actually said to me, Jim, want to be real careful about going in here, because it'll mess up your drinking. And I said, why? And he said, you're going to find a lot of happy people. They have full, rich lives. They've been sober, okay? And ain't no more fun bottles once you go into Alcoholics Anonymous. You can drink again, but true hell is, he said this to me. And see, he had been doing it for 7 years, I just didn't know it. Is a head full of AA and a belly full of alcohol. So don't go in here if you're not serious. Well, I just had to go, you know. And then he said, well, we got to the door, and Stan, some of you may have known, and Roland, some of you may have known, were standing at the door. This is the first thing, you know, talk about profundities when people say profound things to newcomers. I love it when people say, well, we got a newcomer today, let's switch to the first step. I'm going to illustrate, if you did that to me the first 3 or 4 days, here's the kind of mental state I was in. I walked to the door, and Roland said, and Walter said, I'm Walter, and I'm from Louisiana, and this is my friend Jim, and this is his first meeting. And Roland said, you mean that you flew all the way over here from Louisiana to bring us another drunk? We got a whole damn room full of them in there. That's the first thing I ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. And everybody standing around in the room, they just died laughing, just like you just did. I didn't laugh. We went in and we had the meeting, and some good Samaritan, I was sitting on the fourth row end seat in the NABA club on Saturday morning at the Saturday morning meeting, which later became my home group, and that's where I got to know Harold and some other people in this room. And some good Samaritan came down the aisle and handed me a cup of coffee. Now, if you've never had that experience, you check the newcomer out first. Be sure they like maybe came out of treatment and they've been detoxed before you do that. Because I reached up and grabbed hold of that cup of coffee and it went off like a damn rainbird. The next meeting, there wasn't anybody sitting within 2 chairs of me. They were all sitting in a big circle around me. Third meeting, we were going to meeting, and Walter said, you going to pick up a white chip? And I said, no. And he said, well, I'm talking about my mental state. He said, why not? It's not important. You don't have to, you know, that's not a condition of sobriety. I said, Walter, I don't want a white chip. I'm trying to decide whether to sign up for the red one or the green one. And he said, you sick SOB, you don't even understand that, do you? And I said, no. And so he explained it to me, and I went up that meeting in that same meeting room, and this little lady, tiny sweet lady with beautiful white hair, gave me that white chip. It was a mile and a half to go 4 chairs. And I got up there, and when I got close, she handed it to me, and she grabbed me, and she wouldn't turn me loose. And she was hugging and whispering all kinds of stuff I didn't understand in my ears. And I went back and sat down, and of course, Walter was over here 3 chairs, you know, and I started crying, and he said, what's the matter? And he said, what's the matter now? And I said, it's been a long, long time since anybody's hugged me. And those are the two experiences that I've been a hugger ever since in AA. I've been a hugger ever since. I never hugged a man in my life till I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. The first man that ever hugged me, I went to a Klan meeting when I was 5 years old the first time. The first man that ever hugged me was a black man named Decar from Dayton, Ohio. And I almost worship him. He's one of the most spiritual. He was as near Bill Hollingsworth as any man I've ever met. Some of you may have met him. I don't even know if Decar's still alive. Well, Walter left town in 4 days, and he told me, and I'm just telling you what he told me. He said, Jim, he took the meeting book and marked the meetings. He said, I want you to go to these meetings out there in that Sandy Springs area. And he said, stick with these meetings and get you a big book and get a sponsor. And the meetings were all study groups and speaker meetings. None of them were discussion meetings. And so for the first 2 or 3 months until I obtained infant, I got that pretty fast. I went to step. I didn't go to any discussion meetings, so I didn't get real confused about what the steps are about, and you know, like what the 12th step, and you know, and the traditions. I didn't get real confused about that, like a lot of people do, in discussion meetings. I just offer that for a suggestion. I tell every guy I sponsor, if they're brand new or I'm trying to help, if I'm 12 stepping them, try to go to step meetings, big book study meetings, and speaker meetings. I do what most of you do. I pass on what worked for me. Well, let me take a sip. He had said about a sponsor, you know, pick a sponsor. I love that phrase, pick a sponsor. I couldn't pick my nose. I couldn't. I didn't know how to find the first 2 or 3 meetings I ever went to. But he said pick a sponsor, so I picked out 2 guys and decided to interview them. I did. And their names were Bill and Doc. And I'm going to make this quick. I went to them with various questions, and I sat down with Bill down at Coco's on Roswell Road, which I don't think's there anymore. And I said, I got a problem with my wife. We've been having some serious problems. He said, oh, hell, put your sobriety first. Divorce your wife. I divorced my wife, and that'll solve that problem. Put your sobriety first. That's what he said. And I said, this idiot I work for is an idiot. He said, quit the job. Hell. He said, how long you been sober? I said, I don't know, a week and a half or something. I said, a week and a half. And he said, oh, you've been here long enough to know to put your sobriety first. I started my own business. You see what he said? So I went to Doc. And about the wife, he said, you know, when you get the 4th step, that would be a good single subject to write your 4th step. Just write your first 4 step on that little 4-column thing on her. And then see how that comes out. And about the job thing, he said, have you told your boss, the owner of the company? I was the chief executive officer of a $35 million a year company and had been put on probation, and they let me keep my paycheck. And he said, have you told him what you're trying to do? I said, well, they told me not to tell my boss or my employees, the people I work with. And he said, that's not what it says in our literature. And that day, he gave me the greatest gift I've ever had. He said, Jim, when somebody says something to you in AA, if you can find it in the basic fundamentals of the program in the literature, pay a lot of attention to it. But if you can't find it anywhere, be careful. And it talks about that in the book, as you know. So I went and talked to the boss, and he was tickled to death. Absolutely tickled to death. He told Lib later that he was planning to fire me, and that only because I told him what I was trying to do was he willing to stay with me for a little bit longer. Well, I decided to ask guess who to be my sponsor. I applied my keen alkalogical mind to that, and of course it was Bill. At least said everything I wanted to hear. So I went to Bill's house, and by the grace of God, he was drunk as a goat. It turns out he'd been in the hospital, in Northside Hospital, 11 times in 1979. Twice in 1980, and this is just April. Well, that ended that. I decided, well, I I tell you what I decided. I decided if me asking somebody's going to get them drunk, I'm not going to ask anybody to be my sponsor. I mean, I know how to apply my keen alcoholological mind to things. And so the second week, however, I had a wonderful experience. It was a man named Diz who became my second sponsor. His name was Morgan Sylvester Disbro. If you go, unless they've messed with my picture, if you go to NABA Club and go downstairs and look over the cash register, there's a picture there. I put it there. It's in his frying, a frying pan there that has a plaque in it, and it honors Diz. And Diz sat me down, and he said, I want to talk just a few minutes about the steps, and then I'll sign off. He said, Jim, it's about time for you to take the first step. And I said, how do you take the first step? And he opened the big book up, and he said, see right there, it says, on our second visit with the newcomer, we tell him we're available if he's ready to tell his story. And he said, the way you take the first step is to tell your story. And the steps are in sequence in the big book. And the first chapter is Bill's story, so the way to take the first step is to tell your story. And I said, when should I tell my story? He said, how about right now? And I told him my story for about an hour and a half. Now, that was the second wonderful thing that was given to me. I didn't get confused about the first step and the fourth step when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want to do that four-column thing. But I didn't get confused about that in my story. And some of you may not like what I just said. I'm just telling you what was passed on to me. And so everyone I've sponsored since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, first thing I do is ask them to tell me the story. Got through, he said, do you think all those things, you know, growing up on a tenant farm and your daddy was a drunk and your mother was a Bible-thumping zealot and you had to live in the attic of a tenant house that had a tin roof and you had to sleep on the back porch and the screen, you know, on the screen porch in the summertime, and on and on and on, you know. And I brought him up to my wife was a Gritch, and that means grumpy bitch. And you know, and I'm impotent, and I just had, man, I had problems. I told that impotent thing one time for the first time from a podium. I usually mention it only because somebody might need to talk about that, and nobody ever talked about it. I was totally impotent the last 3 years I drank, and in my case, the first 3 years I was sober. Sex is great now, especially the one in the summertime. but I said something about impotence and Gritch, and Lib was sitting up here on the front row, and I heard her turn to somebody next to her, and she said, if you were married to a man who couldn't get it up for 5 or 6 years, you'd be a Gritch too. He said, you think all those things are the reason you drank? I said, I know that. See, here's what I said. I know that's why I drank. That was part of my denial mechanism, but I didn't know that. He said, well, let's put that to a test. You got any brothers and sisters? I said, yeah, I got a brother. He said, does he drink like you do? I said, no, he can't handle it. And he said, well, let me ask you the key question. Did he grow up in the same house you did? And I won't tell you what I said to him, but it was in the nature of stick a sock in it. He stripped away my denial. And he said, Jim, all that stuff about your problems and all that kind of stuff, that has absolutely nothing to do with the physical disease of alcoholism. Nothing. But it has everything to do with your recovery. And it's one of the most profound things in a two-hour session with one person that's ever been said to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, we'll deal with all of that stuff. That's what we got the steps for. But either you believe or you don't believe that you're powerless over alcohol, that you have a disease, and that there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. You're powerless over it. Has nothing to do with all that other stuff. But how well you like living sober and how content you're going to be living sober has everything to do with those problems. We need to deal with all that stuff. I was 2 weeks sober when he told me that. I was in a meeting one time with Doc Crandall's wife, Eileen, and she said about 3 months, and she said, how long you been sober? I said, about 3 months. She said, God, you sound like you've been sober 5 years. And I was, you know, went to my head. I just, God, I loved that. I mean, but I look back on that today, and I say, why did she say that? I mean, this woman had 13 years then. Why did she say that to me? It was because of what I was saying and what I was doing in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in the first few months I was sober. That's why. I was so blessed. I'm the luckiest man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a man that got sober in the late 40s. His sponsor was still living in Charlotte, Dave Cox. And Dave Ray had just died, and he started Alcoholics Anonymous in 1943. I had Doc, who had come in 1951. Now, it took him 13 years to get sober, but he came in this fellowship in 1951. Don't you think that anybody's had trouble getting sober and hadn't got something to give to an idiot like me? They got a lot to give somebody like me. I've never had a sponsor that maintained continuous sobriety from the first meeting. I've had five sponsors. My present sponsor's got 26 years. Well, about 6 weeks, I made some classic mistakes. I my health returned. I felt wonderful. And in my sick alcoholic mind, and I was going to two meetings a day, and I was a non-believer. I wasn't an atheist or an atheist. A non-believer is a person, well, my definition of a non-believer is a person who can hear the word God and hear the word coffee cup, and they mean the same thing. There's no negatives and no positives. And that's the way I was when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a non-believer, and so what I decided was that I had been touched by grace, that I had gotten this wonderful elation, free. All I'd done is not drink and go to meetings. So then I made the second classic mistake. I started listening to the people, what I call the I don't crowd, or I haven't, and so forth. Well, I've been sober 4 years now. I've never written a fourth step. I said, well, I don't need to do that. I've been sober 13 years, and I've never had a daily habit of prayer. And I was on my knees this morning. I don't mind telling you. I've been sober for 19 years. There's a guy here tonight. It's Harold, as a matter of fact, and I were in a meeting. He's an attorney. At that time, had 19 years. And I heard him walk up to me one night. We were talking. I said something about my sponsor, and he said, "I've been sober 19 years, and I've never had a sponsor." By the way, when I was 2 years sober, he got a sponsor. He was in the worst shape of any man over 20 years sober I have ever seen in my damn life. But you see what I did? I internalized all that stuff, and I don't need to do that, and I don't need to do that, and I don't need to do that. So the bottom line is this. I didn't know I did this, but I like this way of telling you. I decided that when the fourth edition of the Big Book comes out, back there right behind Dr. Bob's story was going to be Jim P's story. And it was going to say, the great self-appointed intellectual, big deal, big wheel, Jim P. That's the first sentence. Is the only man in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous who has made 25 years of continuous sobriety and never did a damn thing in this book. That's it. And so I took the second step by not drinking, going to meetings, not believing, and not working steps. And in the end of the third month, into the fourth month, sometime in the fourth month, in July of 1980, I went stark raving sober. I fell on my knees one day. I ran around AA for a couple of years saying I made a decision to get on my knees. I don't remember making the phone call. I don't remember anything that he said to me when he was at the house before we ever went to a meeting. I didn't ask for it. I never had the foggiest idea how to take the first step. All of that stuff just happened to me, didn't it? You know better than that. But I fell on my knees and screamed out the drunkard's prayer. God, please help me. And in my case, I added, and please don't let me go crazy. Because the only thing that made sense to me that day, at that time, at 10 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, July the 26th of 1980, that's how powerful that thing was in my life. But I'm sitting there spinning that 38 and thinking that was the only, and it made sense to me. I don't understand people that commit suicide, but I can damn sure identify with them because it made a lot of, it was the only thing that made sense to me. I didn't want to drink. I just want to check out. My obsession, by the way, is not drinking in sobriety. My obsession is with checking out. It has been on four or five occasions in 15 years. Well, we're about to run out of time. I'm giving me credit for the long announcements. So that was the second thing I did. And then I will try to wind it up by telling you. Doc couldn't get me to write the fourth step. And he made lists and he talked about things in meetings and one thing and another. And God, in God's infinite wisdom, put a man named Steve T. I don't use his last name because he's not here and he's still living. Steve T. Young man, now imagine this. You're looking at me. You see what I look like. And I was a hotshot big executive. I thought I was anyway. And this guy walks up to me, and he says, "Hey, man, will you be my sponsor?" And he had dirty, oily hair and filthy clothes. Stunk. God, he stunk. And he would talk in meetings, especially out on in the Sandy Springs area. When he'd start talking, he'd go straight manic. And he'd end up running around the room talking real loud. He was crazy as hell. And he had a ring or two here and there, you know, and here's old conservative apex homeboy Jim Pearson, a recovering redneck alcoholic, and he wore Birkenstock sandals, and that's enough to whip his ass right there. I wear Birkenstocks now. When I was in the Navy, we used to go hunting for those guys with those sandals. Find somebody to roll. I'm serious. We did in San Diego. Everybody's sick when they get here. I was a sick, sick, sick human being when I came here. The dark and destructive side of my nature was demonic. Anyway, he walks up and he said, "Hey man, have you been my sponsor?" And in my infinite wisdom, I said, "This is 4 months sober." I said, "Yes." And then he said, "I want to work the steps." I should have known right then what was going on. He said, "When you took the first step, how'd you do it?" I just whipped that right on him. Read him out of the book, told him to tell the story. He said, "Could I tell you my story right now?" I noticed, by the way, and I think this was my first experience in AA, 4 months sober was when I did. I noticed driving home that night that I had a sense of worth and feeling good about myself. It was kind of like, Jim, is there no end to your goodness? That's the first, near as I know, that's the first time, and I've said this in front of my wife many times, that's the first time in my life I have ever cared more about another person than I did about myself, without having it be an exchange, without having to get something back. And of course, a couple of weeks later, he gave me, what'd you do when you did the second step? And I told him. And then he came to me, and he said, Jim, and I had not done this, see. He came to me and he said, Jim, I want to take the third step with you. Would you be willing to get down on your knees here? And let's say that third step prayer together. And I said, yeah. And that's the first time I ever took the third step. Down there on my knees with him. Now the next week, I knew what was going to happen. He came and he said, when you wrote that four step using that crazy four column thing I can't figure out, he said, how'd you do it? I said, what are you doing Saturday? He said, I don't know. I said, meet me at the club Saturday. I went to Bob Carver and Doc and everybody else I could think of, Diz, Roland, and asked them, how you do that? And they actually explained it to me. Well, a couple of them did. And I've had somebody show me the eight sentences in the big book that I underlined. I've still got that book, and they're still underlined. I got that book right there that tell you exactly how to do the fourth step in the eight sentences. I couldn't find those eight sentences. There's a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous can't find those eight sentences. And so I started writing, and Saturday I met with him, and I laid it on him. I told him how to do it. I said, see this, and underline these sentences, and then it, you know what the little snot did? He went up to the Blue Ridge Parkway with his son from his estranged wife and came back down the mountain in 10 days and had the whole thing written and came to me and said, and I'm writing like mad trying to stay ahead of him. And he said, when you took the fifth step, how did you do it? I said, this is a true story. And I said, what are you doing Saturday? The bottom line is that Steve T., who has within 3 or 4 months of the same sobriety I've got, sponsored me as a brand newcomer through all the first 9 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I need to wind it up. I want to say that one of the great baffling things to me was my concept of God. And I'd like to share 2 things and I'll sign off. I've heard a lot of things in meetings about punishing God and negative God and Baptist God and this God and that God. And I had all those things drilled into me when I was a kid. But that underneath that was a fundamental thing that was blocking me from a relationship with God. It was not fear of it being punishing God. I got past that in AA. Underneath that was the notion of trying to make God something rather than everything. It's just that simple. And my whole struggle with a relationship with my higher power was based on trying to make God something rather than everything. Now, I know that now. I didn't know that at the time. So I went to see Father Damien over at the monastery in Georgia. And we had several sessions, little 3-hour sessions, and then you go to Vespers afterwards. And I'm not a Christian, but I love Father Damien. And by the way, I think Jesus was a hell of a fellow. I don't get me wrong. I was raised a Christian. But one day he said, this is the story I want to tell. And he said, Jim, why are you driving over here 50 miles coming to see me? And I said, I don't think I know. He said, that's about the first true thing you've said to me since you've been coming over here. He said, why don't we try to figure that out? And in about an hour, we came down to two questions. What is God's will for me is what I wanted to know. And secondly, how does it feel to love God and be loved by God? How does it feel? Now, I'm talking to a monk in a monastery. It was easy to knock out the first one, and to this day, I'm happy. Bill used to say, you know, if you think God's a stranger, he said, did you ever ask a stranger to give you a drink? I said, yeah. Well, he said, well, why don't you ask a stranger to help you stay sober? That makes as much sense to me as anything I've ever heard. Maggie told me one time, well, the 12 steps are a part of grading yourself. Why don't you try that? That's profound. Because I discovered God through the process. It's just simple. See, but, you know. Anyway, God's will for me is that I live in harmony with His world. That's God's will for me. But now to the question of what does it feel like to love God and be loved by God? See, again, I'm looking for something really esoteric. It had to be to fit my image of my primary psychiatric diagnosis is narcissistic personality disorder, in case you haven't figured that out yet. He said, Jim, you remember telling me that you knocked your daddy on his butt when you were 17, you left home, said you'd never come back. I said, yeah. He said, you remember that Sarah wrote you that letter and said that that you were drunk and that she didn't want to speak to you or be in your presence again. I said, yeah, I really remember that. He said, suppose 5 years go by and she doesn't show up. And you and Lib worry about it a little bit. 5 more years, you get a private detective, and you actually spend a lot of money trying to find her. Be sure she's all right. Doesn't work. 10 years go by, and that's a total of 20 years, and you're beginning to not think about it a whole lot. And 30 years go by, and one night, you and Lib are sitting by the fire and watching a movie, and a knock comes on the door. And you open the door, and there stands what is obviously a woman with stringy hair, wine sores, drunk, needle marks in her arm, barefooted, ragged dress. And she says, Daddy, I know you don't know who I am, but it's Sarah. Can I come in? And then he asked me, he said, how do you feel right now? And I couldn't talk. And he said, Father Damien said, I think that's as close as we'll ever come in our life to knowing what it feels like to love God and be loved by God. But I think He loves you a whole lot more than that. And I think He loves you a whole lot more than that. Thank you.